Hi, I'm Paul Schrempf, and welcome to Microdosing, where we look at small specific things that represent bigger trends in the business of healthcare. In this season, we'll be talking to product professionals, product managers, product developers, innovation, experience, R&D, and the various titles people go by. It continues to be one of the fastest growing professions, yet everyone has a different take on it. We likely won't quell any debates, but hopefully we'll walk away with a better understanding of the space and what good looks like. I hope you enjoy. Hi, today we're joined by Alex Mosman. Alex, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
All right, let's dive right on in. What is the 2 minute, Alex?
I came up a long, long time ago working in advertising, kind of got tired of building the thing to tell people about the thing they wanted to use. I just wanted to build the thing that people could actually use and leverage. And so that got me into the fun-filled, fast-paced world of product, hanging around enough developers and designers and researchers to understand that there's an actual capability there. Started off in startups, so did a lot of platform as a service, software as a service, building a lot of apps, first-in-kind capabilities. From there, moved into more pure-play product innovation, helping large companies come up with physical products, digital products, and connected devices, and did a lot in especially medical technology, medical electronics, in the medical device industry. And then from there, started working at Samsung, as they needed some capability and support building out a new methodology for product innovation and taking emerging technologies and productizing them and just figuring out why anybody would actually want to use those and buy them. So built out a studio and scaled it up. And then post-COVID, decided that my capabilities were better suited in terms of a broad range of different clients and different industries. And so that got me into the fun-filled, fast-paced world of consulting, where I'm currently the global head of digital product at a global consultancy called Profit, where I was fortunate to meet you, Paul, and get to work with you, but really helping clients across a range of different industries solve difficult and challenging growth problems around bringing customer and business value together.
And then we go in the fun question of, which is an easy question, but actually hard to answer.
Oh, yeah.
What's your definition of product management?
I mean, I think that's a fun one. Product management is not monolithic. There are so many permutations to it, depending on the size of the company, the industry you're in, what type of product you're delivering. There are a lot of permutations and variations to it. The way I like to think about it is really the role of product management is to help cross-functional teams just make better decisions around customer and business value and bringing that to market. And so it's a bit of skirting the issue, but ultimately your job is not to direct, your job is to support and influence and help different people with different backgrounds work together and understanding that the ultimate goal of product in general is being able to deliver customer and business value simultaneously. So connecting the dots between business strategy and objectives that businesses have, but understanding what the market actually demand is and being able to connect that in a way that delivers solutions that hopefully deliver on both of those goals.
That's been come up a number of times. I like the, it's not monolithic because I believe that's a, call it a red flag, kiss of death, whatever analogy you want to use. Whenever I hear a new product leader going into an organization saying, that's not how we do it. This is how we did someplace else. I'm like, totally. Whenever somebody in product says, this is how we did someplace else and we're going to do it here, I'm like, red flag. They may or may not be right. Usually they're not, but that always scares me because you can't copy and paste from organization to organization, which I think is a great call out. And I'd also like you to expand more when you said the word product management is not here to direct, I'm here to guide.
Yes.
And that's come up a number of instances. And it sounds warm and fuzzy, and it sounds very progressive, but say more about this interesting divide because people keep making a point going, I don't direct my teams, I just provide the guidance, but say more on that.
So I think that's the big bit of it. Product management as a function is not what would classically be called, you know, project management or program management, where we come up with a bunch of requirements, we hand it off to a bunch of functional capabilities to make sure that the thing gets done and then tick it off when it's done. The goal of product management is actually to build the constraint and the definition of what is it that we're trying to deliver. So when we're less focused on the pace and the speed of us getting a product or a feature to market, I was working with a big client recently in retail that was moving to e-commerce. And the big issue they were running into is a lot of their teams internally were used to, we need to get a certain number of customers in the door, a certain number of SKUs on the shelves, like very output focused, very numerically focused. And when your churn and your change becomes now about how do we actually ensure that we're delivering the thing that our customers actually want in the way that they want it. And how do we measure these things that become more qualitative, maybe not in the non-empirical sense, but get beyond just a pace to something or a frequency to something? The role of product management is to help qualify, okay, what is the problem that we're actually trying to solve? And how will we know that we've solved that problem in setting some empirical measures or some tests that we can use to evaluate our capability, but not being prescriptive in this is exactly what the solution should look like. And this is how you build it. And this is the specification you build it to. And I think part of the problem with product management as a just a sort of canon or as a capability is for a long time, it was seen as wranglers for developers and engineers. And the job was to write a bunch of product requirements, get it in there, and then tick it off and make sure it hits the release date. And more traditional product managers have a difficulty with this sort of newer model in which the goal is not just to deliver. Delivery is key, because if you don't deliver, no one uses it and it doesn't matter. But delivering in a way that actually delivers an outcome, more customers coming back, higher retention, growth, more money, those lagging indicators that the product is delivering on. And so the role, again, going back to it, you know, product is a team sport. You're going to have to bring in different and diverse capabilities and points of view to be able to deliver anything. The role of product management that is sort of unique, I would say, within that product team is being able to help constrain what is the problem that we're actually trying to solve and how will we know that we do that, and making sure that we get as many administrative and infrastructure and just complications and blockers that can happen within an organization or within just ways of working out of the way of the team, so the team can focus on really cracking that problem and coming up with a solution that delights and pleases, but also delivers on core fundamental business values. That's, I think, the distinctive difference that product management brings to the table, especially when it works really well.
Yeah. I'm going to try this question out or get this going to see where it takes us. Because I want to believe what you just riffed on has been talked about either as a product management storyline or just a business storyline or a leadership storyline. Like, I've been popping open LinkedIn for the last 7 to 10 years. It's going, you know, lead, set objectives, don't manage tasks. Like, we talk about this ad nauseum. Why is it not getting done consistently? Or when you're seeing it not get done, what's getting in the way? Because I can't disagree with anything that you just said.
Sure.
And I do believe it is altruistically true. And when I see it happen, good things happen. Why isn't it happening in more places more often?
I think there's a couple key reasons why it's difficult to go from a legacy approach to that more outcome-focused approach. The first one, really, at least the one that feels like it's most prominent, is quarterly business results. We need to show every quarter that we're delivering X amount of shareholder value, and our X amount of shareholder value is dependent on the channels that we have, the capabilities that we deliver, and the processes by which we make that as efficient as possible. And you're seeing that in the market now, right? Post 0% interest rates, you know, the thing that people can leverage against, unfortunately, is staff. And so the thing that we're focusing on is less about how do we drive better outcomes and more about how do we just make ourselves more efficient to make more money. So I'd say the biggest one in terms of being able to change that mindset away from better outcomes is just the little bit of heroin drip that we have to quarterly business results. The second one, I think, is there is a lot of legacy technology and legacy capability, and a lot of the fundamentals of great businesses is in being able to efficiently deliver something at scale over and over again, which is great. Yep. What is not well tuned to, and this is the innovator's dilemma, is being able to reinvent that capability or reposition that capability so that you're not just focused on, you know, delivering what you can do better, faster, quicker, larger, but being able to use that to also discover where are there new opportunities to move adjacent, move into new markets, and reposition capabilities. And then that's the third bit of it is it's that top-down strategic vision that's really strong enough and really thoughtful enough to be able to say, if we want to do something different and be something different and grow into the market differently, then we actually have to empower the teams, the capabilities, and reorient ourselves cross-organizationally, cross-functionally, to be able to deliver on that. And the history of our education systems, a lot of our career systems, just are basically focused on functional alignment. Yeah. And you start off as an apprentice and you work your way up. And it definitely, I don't want a heart surgeon to work on me who last week was an accountant. Yeah. Like, you want people who have certain level of craft levels in those specialist places. But in business, especially at the pace that the market's moving and the pace that customer demand is moving and technologies that underlie all of that, you really need more of that cross-organizational capability to be able to outpace or at least keep pace with the marketplace.
Yeah, I'd agree with a number of those points. I'm often ask myself, what exactly did I know and do 20 years ago that's still relevant? And that list is getting smaller and smaller. I mean, I could argue even the stuff I did 10 years ago, you know, I can't like, I did this back in 2005. Let's do this again. I just don't do that. And I liked your other pieces around just the organizational biases. One, quarterly EBITDA. That's why I believe that most innovation will continue to come from the startup space. And if you are a big company investing in innovation, you're probably have started a VC arm or something to where you can get that same ecosystem of success. And the other one is just the career bias. You got the quarterly pieces, but the other one that you triggered me, and this I will go back to 2005. I was working in CPG, big potato chip company. But that organization, like most CPG companies, had an interesting executive rotation program where brand managers would do two-year rotations and just move on. And there was, looking back, inherent pressure on creating a two-year story for yourself. And I was on the agency side on research and product development, more product testing, not necessarily product development. Sure. But we'd just see list after list of bad product ideas. But it would get to 8 months down the road from idea to concept, and it showed some legs. And all of a sudden, that became the brand manager's baby. And what they were going to make their career on for the next 2 years. And even if it was a bad idea, and even if the work I did that said it was a bad idea, they'd still shove it forward, prop it up with merchandising, going, look at this thing sell. They get promoted out at the end of the 2 year cycle, product collapses, and the next person comes in, but they go, 90% of products fail. I'm like, I think it's because people are just trying to get promoted. That was the motivation on launching stuff, but it was another one of those biases. One, it was the EBITDA piece, which I've seen in spades in funding and trying to get stuff out the door. Totally. But a lot of times I see a lot of bad products go out because internal career story has nothing to do with needs or experience.
That really resonates. I mean, A, I want to become a product tester at a potato chip company. That sounds like a wonderful job. But beyond that, I think the beauty of product in a lot of ways is it's very binary. The product works or it doesn't. People buy it, they don't. And there's a beauty in that litmus test of product market fit that I think is very, it can be very scary. It is part of the reason why a lot of products fail. A lot of products should fail. But it also, there's a simplicity in that you can't hide behind the way you can in, you know, some strategic internal roles or in certain other parts of industry. And what I find fascinating about that is because of that, you're really at the dependency of the market. And you can't outsmart the market. You often can't outwork the market. Really, the goal is to understand the market in a level of depth and a level of capability that is nuanced and differentiated than even, say, marketing or sales, because you really have to be able to say not only what are the needs, but then how can you position your capabilities around it and deliver on it? And when I go back to what is the role of product management, at least in my mind, the role of product management is to be able to distill down so clearly and so fundamentally, what is that market opportunity and what is that market need, and really understand the criteria that surrounds it, the conditions surrounding it, the business model surrounding it, like all of the different elements that play into that in a way that you can provide that to a product team so succinctly and so directly that it gives them the space to play, to unlock all of the cool, interesting bits and to bring emerging technology and business models and mindsets and capabilities to bring out delightful experiments. But it is that market attenuation that I think is distinctively different from how product people and product managers in general sort of see the opportunities than, say, legacy businesses, which are not focused on outsmarting the market, but are definitely focused on playing the market or optimizing against the market.
I love that phrasing because, again, I came up through the world of market research, which is develop a product, test it. And then once we feel good it's going to be successful, then we launch it, which is an antiquated idea. Still very good for, say, drug development, even good for like car manufacturing when you got to build a big supply chain. But this phrase that you use, one, don't try to outsmart the market. Be smart, be logical.
Yeah.
But those that have been in the space long enough are always surprised at what they thought was going to be successful fail. And some can't even articulate why a certain success was a success. It just was. And I like the phrase, and I've been using this lately, even in my own world, like it's either going to work or it's not. Right. And it's such a new philosophy for my brain to get my head wrapped around. And once I go, I'm going to do some things, or I'm going to build a product, it's either going to work or it's don't. So therefore, oh, I should probably build a lot of them or have a portfolio of ideas.
Yeah.
And then just let it figure itself out. It's either going to work or it's not. Yeah. And if it doesn't, most of the time, it's not a bad thing. We all move forward. And then that's where the old fail fast keeps coming up. Like totally. The sooner I know something doesn't work, the more money I save.
Yep.
Like people just don't realize that the sooner that you recognize something that's not working, you've just saved a lot of money. But if you draw out that failure.
Oh, yeah.
That's the wrong play.
Those are good points. It's funny that you mentioned that because a few years back when I was in-house and I was working at a very large consumer electronics company and one of the regional C-suite, who was definitely a finance background, asked me, so how much money can we make off this idea that we hadn't even tested? It was just a value proposition. So one of the many cool, interesting ideas that we were coming up with. And he said, we're interested in billion-dollar products. That's what we need, is we need a billion-dollar product. And I said, okay, well, if you give me the better part of $100,000, I can tell you whether or not we have a billion-dollar product. And he said, well, we're going to have a billion-dollar product. I'm like, okay. And of course, in $100,000, we found out there was no market there. There was no capability to actually deliver that from that brand in a way that the market would actually demand. And when invariably I got called in front of the C-suite to answer for why we didn't have a billion-dollar product, I said, I just saved you $900,999. I just saved you a ton of money that you can now go spend and find that billion-dollar product. And I think the understanding, to your point, build, test, learn, the lean product methodologies, that mindset, it's not about trying to beat the market or outpace the market. It's about trying to find as quickly as possible the things that don't work so that you can get to the thing that does work and is valuable and is important as quick as possible. And one of the benefits, I think, of some of the emerging technologies, especially with AI, is it just increases the pace at which you can get through the bad ideas so that you can get to those good ideas. And it doesn't mean that your ideas are better empirically. I think the quality is probably about the same as you'd get from a junior level talent in any industry. But the pace at which you can get past those and get to hopefully things that resonate are more impactful and most importantly, deliver more value to customers. That's the key. That's the goal. And that's how you should build and tune your systems.
Yeah. And I'm going to get flack for this. There is some risk, but like when things don't work, it's not always that dire. And I was going off some inspiration. I just happened to have a conversation with somebody that when I looked at their trajectory, I'm like, oh, they worked at these three companies. The three companies are no longer in business.
Right.
But the people that I happen to work with that worked at those companies in that kind of tribe are at new companies that are highly successful.
Yep.
So you can say those companies failed in certain ways, but the talent that came out of those and where that talent is and where it's doing for in the world of healthcare is quite remarkable. So it's like even the definition of failure and talent, but like everybody I know that keeps playing in this space and taking risk and kind of building products, we all move forward and some of our businesses move forward also, some don't, but collectively there's better shit getting done. But sometimes it's in a vessel that is a fiscal failure for 1 year.
Sure.
And then the idea moves to another fiscal vessel that takes off. But the downside isn't that down. I don't know anybody sleeping under a bridge right now. I don't. Well, I do. But like in the world white collar product development aspect, I don't know anybody sleeping under a bridge.
I think that's absolutely right. And there's a really great group of innovators, corporate innovation capability team. And one of their points is the worst thing that can happen, especially in early stage product development, even in late stage product development, is being doomed to succeed. If everybody's betting the farm on this product is going to succeed, this is going to be the thing that brings us through, that delivers it, you're already being set up to have a failing product. The benefit of this is very much an evolutionary story, is being able to build, test, learn, and things that will work and may work for a period of time or for a certain customer base or a certain market or a specific need may be great. But if they're not scalable beyond that, or they can't actually deliver returns ongoing, or their moment in time has passed, then the best thing to do is to learn from that and be able to take the good lessons to apply them to the thing that we can build forward and to bring it full circle back. This is what outcomes over outputs is. The outcome is actually trying to build a better future and be a part of the teams and grow the teams and the capabilities to do that. And it's less about making the same thing that we've been doing as best as possible in a dogmatic way, because that's all we know. And I think that attenuation is really important and unfortunately not widespread, but then again, that gives me the opportunity to help a lot of people try and get there, hopefully.
We are having no problem fitting in a lot of great conversation, which is why I always like catching up with you, whether we're recording or not. So we do have to bring this conversation to an end with the ever-present closing question. If Alex Mosman could go back and tell his younger self one thing, what would that be?
Just get really, really good at soccer so he can be a goalie for Manchester United. But besides that, I would say the most important thing really is to focus on asking the single best question. I think a lot of times the focus is on having all the answers, and especially for product people, our role is not to be the ones to have all the answers, but to really know what is the question or set of questions that will help focus things. And so really training yourself to focus on what is the one most important question to focus what we're trying to deliver on or best unlock where the opportunity lies. That's a skill set, and that's a secret skill that you'll just spend a lifetime on. But if you get really good at that, it's insanely impactful. At least in my experience, it has been.
Yeah, that's sound advice. It overlaps with a few other points that were made earlier in the series where somebody gave a little shout out and appreciation to one of his mentors, which was she always pushed their team to ask more questions. Like the amount of times she would say, ask more questions when a meeting was almost like predictable.
Oh, yeah.
But it goes, it's that consistent genre of here to direct, guide, set objectives, and then ask questions, which is very congruent to or counterintuitive to the old way of top-down directive, do it my way kind of culture, which I think has popped up in a few elements of our conversation as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. 100%.
Awesome. Alex, as always, you never disappoint. Thanks for a great conversation. So many good nuggets to carry forward. And thank you for taking a few minutes of your time to share it with others.
Always a pleasure, Paul. Thank you so much. And I'm glad to have spent the time with you.
Thank you for listening to Microdosing. For more thoughts, perspectives, and opinions like this, go to www.md-pod.com. For media professionals, while I am flattered, please do not reach out to pitch your ideas or to interview your clients. This might confuse people, but I am not a media professional. Microdosing is not a revenue-generating podcast. I'm an operator, advisor, and investor. This is how I make my income. Conversations with experts is just how I learn, and podcasting is a simple way for people in my network to learn from one another. This podcast isn't about making money. It's about learning, sharing, and allowing ourselves to have a little fun along the way. Until next time, cheers.